to rural Bolivia, caught a ride on a World War II paratrooper plane that hauled frozen meat. The only other passengers were a farmer, his pig, his sheep, and his dog. When the plane hit turbulence, the animals scattered. As Paul and the farmer lunged to capture them, the co-pilot turned and screamed, "Stop shaking the plane! You're going to make us crash!" Paul is the type of person who can handle a trip to Toraja. Then, he invited me to tag along. But to warn you, the trip itself is a pain in the ass. Several months later, we touched down in Jakarta, the largest city in Indonesia. Indonesia is made up of more than 17,000 islands and boasts the fourth largest population in the world, behind China, India, and the United States. To catch our next flight, we shuffled through passport control. "Where are you traveling to in Indonesia?" asked the pleasant young woman at the desk. "Tana Toraja." An impish grin crossed her face. "You are going to see the dead bodies?"
"Yes."
"Oh, really?" She seemed taken aback, as if her initial question was just to make polite conversation. "The dead bodies, do you know, are they walking by themselves?"
"No, the family holds them up. They aren't like zombies," Paul replied.
"I'm afraid of them." She turned to share a nervous laugh with her co-worker in the next booth as she stamped us through. When we finally arrived in Makassar, the capital of the island of South Sulawesi, I had been awake for 39 hours. As we exited the airport into the heavy air, Paul was swarmed like a celebrity. I forgot to mention that Paul in person looks just as outlandish as his house, a claim I lay with the utmost aesthetic respect. He has thick dreadlocks, a beaded wizard beard, and tattoos. He traveled in a purple velvet frock coat and a top hat with an ermine skull attached to the brim. No one knows his age. He was once described by a mutual friend of ours as an 18th century highwayman reimagined by Tim Burton. Paul refers to himself as a cross between Prince and Vlad the Impaler. Men ceased their frantic taxi-hawking in order to get a closer look at Paul's tattoos and his skull hat. Paul's visual strangeness gets him through locked doors and into secret monasteries and bone caves that no one else would have access to. People are too confounded to refuse him. There was no time for a nap at a hotel. We found our driver and were whisked away on our 8-hour drive north. Green rice fields stretched out on either side of the road, and water buffalo plopped languidly into baths of mud. As we navigated the southern lowlands, we heard the Muslim call to prayer pumped through the speakers of the roadside mosques. The majority of Indonesians are Muslim, but in the remote mountains of Tana Toraja, the people follow an animistic religion called Aluk Tudolo, the Way of the Ancestors, until the Dutch introduced Christianity in the early 1900s. We hit the mountains not long after. Our driver barreled the SUV up winding two-lane roads, dodging and swerving around mopeds and trucks in a never-ending game of automobile chicken. Not speaking his language, I finally had to act out the universal symbol for, "Seriously, bro, I'm going to vomit." By the time we arrived in Toraja, I was starting to hallucinate from lack of sleep. But Paul, who had enjoyed multiple naps on the plane, wanted to photograph a series of nearby burial caves before dark. There was no one at the Londa burial caves when we pulled up. Up against the cliff, set on rickety scaffolding, were stacks of coffins made of udu wood, shaped like boats, buffaloes, and pigs. Radiocarbon dating shows that coffins like these have been used in Toraja since 800 BC. Skulls peeked out of the cracks in the wood like nosy neighbors, watching our arrival. As the wood of the coffins decomposes, the bones they contain will go rolling and spilling down the side of the cliff. Even more surreal, the coffin sat next to rows and rows of tau tau,
the Tarajan's realistic wooden effigies of the dead, seated like an important village council. They represent the souls of the anonymous bones scattered in the cave. The older Tautau are crudely carved, with oversized white eyes and straggled wigs. More modern Tautau are distressing in their realism, with finely lined faces, convincing warts, and veined skin. They wear eyeglasses, clothes, and jewelry, and look ready to pry themselves up by their canes and welcome us in. Inside the darkened cave, skulls lined the crevices and natural ledges in the stone. Some were artfully arranged in pyramid-shaped stacks and rows, while some were left upside down. Some were bleached white, and others were vivid green, covered in moss. Some had cigarettes posed jauntily in their mouths. A lower jawbone, missing the rest of its skull, smoked two cigarettes at once. Paul motioned me to follow him through a small hole, to what I imagined was another chamber of the cave. Crouching and squinting into the darkness, I saw this move would require crawling on my stomach through a tunnel. "Yeah, that's okay. I'll stay here." Paul, who sometimes breaks into abandoned copper and pumice mines in the Los Angeles area, because of course he does, crawled away. The tails of his velvet frock coat disappeared into the hole. My cell phone, my only source of light, was at 2% battery life. So I powered it down and sat in the dark among the skulls. Minutes went by, maybe 5, maybe 20, when a lantern broke through the darkness. It was a family, a mother and several teenagers, Indonesian tourists from Jakarta. From their perspective, I must have looked like a possum trapped by car headlights against a garage wall. In gracious, elevated English, a young man positioned himself at my elbow and said, "Excuse me, miss. If you will direct your attention to the camera, we will create an Instagram." Flashes started going off, sending my image to #LondaCaves. Strange as this felt in the moment, I could see why the discovery of a 6-foot-tall white girl in a polka-dot dress in the corner of a cave filled with skulls would be an Instagrammable moment. They took several pictures with me in different poses before moving on. I woke refreshed after 14 comatose hours in our hotel in the city of Rantapau. We went to meet our guide, a goose, in the lobby. He was compact and fit, handsome. A goose had been taking Dutch and German tourists on deep jungle and rafting treks for 25 years, but in recent years had developed a special death-focused relationship with Paul. Agus told us that the Menene, the ritual we had come to see, wouldn't happen until tomorrow, on Taraja time. Today's adventure would be an appetizer to the Menene, a Tarajan funeral. We wound down endless dirt roads in Agus's SUV through the emerald green hills. For several miles, we were caught behind a moped with a hairy black pig tied down with a neon green rope behind the driver. I scooted myself forward in my seat. Was the pig dead? As if on cue, the pig's hooves went into a swimming motion. A goose caught me looking. "Pigs are harder to carry on a bike than a person. They squirm." The pig was heading to the same Tarajan funeral we were. One of us would not be coming back. You could hear the funeral before you saw it, drums and cymbals crashing. We entered the swirl of people following behind the corpse. The body was being transferred in a replica of a traditional Tarajan house. These houses, known as tongkongnan, resemble no residence you've ever seen, standing high on stilts with a roof that swoops up to 2 points in the sky. This corpse, inside his mini house, was carried atop the shoulders of 35 young men. The crowd jostled into the central courtyard as the corpse made its way around the periphery. It was slow going. The house was heavier than expected, and the men had to stop every 30 seconds or so and set it down. In the center of the courtyard stood a buffalo, robust and serious in its demeanor. The buffalo's presence implied a vague threat of what was to come. Staked to the ground by a short rope, it looked like the lamb left out for the hungry T-Rex in Jurassic Park. As Chekhov said about the theater, if you reveal a gun on stage in Act One, it better go off by the final act. Tourists, at least the ones I could tell were tourists because of their white skin and Western European accents, were corralled in the far back corner of the courtyard. This is the primary tension of Taraj's death tourism industry. How to get the tourists close, but not too close. Our exile in Section J seemed more than fair to me, and I plunked myself down to observe as Paul set up his camera for photographs. Today, he wore an outfit better suited to the humid weather. Denim overalls, a sheriff's badge, polka dot socks, and a cowboy hat. There were some tourists who did not get the hint. One couple perched themselves in the folding chairs alongside the dead man's family in the VIP section. The locals were too polite to ask them to leave. An older German woman with crudely dyed blonde hair walked directly into the center of the courtyard through the unfolding festivities, taking photographs with her iPad thrust into local children's faces and chain-smoking Marlboro Reds. I wanted to yank her out with a vaudeville cane. Tourism in Tana Toraja is a recent development, almost unheard of before the 1970s. The Indonesian government had concentrated on developing tourism, to great success, on other islands, like Bali and Java. But Tana Toraja had something those other places didn't. Impressive, ritualistic death. They no longer wanted to be viewed by the rest of Indonesia as a place of headhunters and black magic, but as participants in a high culture tradition. The corpse made its way into the courtyard. The men carrying the house thrust it up and down, chanting and grunting. They went at it until they exhausted themselves and had to set the whole house down, then took a deep breath and did it again. It was hypnotic to watch the surging effort, especially compared to the staid pace of a standard pallbearer's procession in the West. The corpse was, is, if you're Tarajan, that of a man named Rovinus Linton. He was important to the village, a government worker and a farmer. Behind me stood a 5-foot-high color poster of Rovinus's face. The image showed a man in his late 60s in a sharp blue suit and a pencil-thin John Waters mustache. Children in elaborate beaded costumes ran through the courtyard, dodging the men carrying squealing pigs tied to bamboo stakes. The men were taking the pigs to a hidden back area. The door of the main house was closed off by a hanging tapestry featuring a full roster of Disney princesses. Belle, Ariel, and Aurora watched the pigs pass to the slaughter. I wondered if the moped pig from earlier in the day was among them. These Tarajan funerals are not casual BYOB, bring-your-own-buffalo events. Each pig and sacrificial animal had been brought by a different family and carefully recorded. There is a system of debts that keeps people coming to funerals for years. As a goose said, "You bring a pig to my mother's funeral now, I will bring one for you someday." Tarajan and American death culture share this particular trait of overexpenditure. No one wants to be perceived as disrespecting the dead. All of these rituals might seem complicated, but Agus claimed they have actually become far less so. His parents were born into the animistic Aluk religion, but his father converted to Catholicism at age 16. Agus gave his theory. There are 7,777 rituals in Aluk. People left because it got too complicated. Catholicism hardly seems the place to go for fewer complicated rituals, but there you go. The crowd went silent as the priest came over the loudspeaker and began his sermon. I didn't understand the words, but he punctuated his speech with salutes to the deceased, booming, "Rovinus Linton!" at top volume. For 20 minutes he spoke. And when he started to lose the crowd with the repetitive phrasing, he screamed into the microphone like a death metal rocker. Let me tell you, if you're sitting next to a speaker and don't see a coming, it can be devastating. Agus translated the expression as something akin to listen up. In recent years, the narration at Taranjan funerals, as well as the choreography and costume choices, has taken cues from television variety shows. Rovinus had died, as Western medicine would define the term, at the end of May, 3 months earlier. But according to Taranjan tradition, Rovinus remained living. He might have stopped breathing, but his physical state was more like a high fever, an illness. This illness would last until the first animal, a buffalo or a pig, was sacrificed. After the sacrifice, makaru dusan, to exhale the last breath, Rovinus could at last die alongside the animal. During his 2 years of fieldwork in Taraja, anthropologist Dimitri Singelonis developed a close friendship with a local woman named Ne Layuk, who referred to Dimitri as one of her children. He came back to Taraja 9 years later, excited to surprise Ne Layuk with his joyous return, only to discover she had died 2 weeks prior to his arrival. Dimitri went to visit her corpse and was led into the back room by a family member, who announced to Ne Layuk that Dimitri was back. Looking at her face, I crouched down by her side and whispered my greetings. Although one side of her face seemed to be slightly crumbling, she looked serene and composed. She was only asleep, and she knew I was there. More than that, she could hear me and see me. In fact, she was not dead. She was only ill and could feel everything. In Taraja, during the period of time between death and the funeral, the body is kept in the home. That might not sound particularly shocking until I tell you that period can last from several months to several years. During that time, the family cares for and mummifies the body, bringing the corpse food, changing its clothes, and speaking to the body. The first time Paul ever visited Taraja, he asked Agus if it was unusual for a family to keep a dead relative in the home. Agus laughed at the question. When I was a child, we had my grandfather in the home for 7 years. My brother and I, we slept with him in the same bed. In the morning, we put his clothes on and stood him up against the wall. At night, he came back to bed. Paul describes death in Taraja, as he's witnessed it, not as a hard border, an impenetrable wall between the living and the dead, but a border that can be transgressed. According to their animistic belief system, there is also no barrier between the human and non-human aspects of the natural world, animals, mountains, and even the dead. Speaking to your grandfather's corpse is a way to build a connection to that person's spirit. The priest had gone silent, his last "Koi!" fading mercifully from the loudspeaker. Paul sidled up beside me and whispered, "After they sacrificed the buffalo, maybe one of the tourists should be next." As if on cue, two men walked toward the buffalo. One threaded a blue rope through its metal nostril ring. The man was gentle with the buffalo, scratching its chin. The buffalo seemed not to notice it had become the center of attention. The second man squatted down to tie the buffalo's front hooves to wooden stakes in the ground. I was expecting, I'm not sure, another chant, a gathering of family members, but it only took seconds for the man to lift the buffalo's chin by the rope, pull a machete from his belt, and slice directly into its throat. The buffalo reared back into the air, its powerful muscles and horns on display. It attempted to flee, but the rope kept it in place. There was a vivid red gash on its throat, but no blood was falling. The first cut was not deep enough. Several more men rushed forward, grabbing at the rope strung through the buffalo's nose, but the buffalo wasn't having it. It bucked and thrashed, exposing its severed windpipe to the crowd. It was not easy to watch. The man pulled out a machete from his belt, giving the neck a second chop. This time the buffalo's throat pulsed electric red blood. The buffalo jerked back with enough force to break itself free from the wooden stake. It stumbled to the right and barreled into the crowd. There was chaos, screaming. The footage from my small video camera went into Cloverfield mode, heavy breathing and sweeping shots of the ground. The crowd surged around me and I sliced my hand on the edge of a concrete pillar. I was sure someone, probably me, would fall victim to the buffalo's revenge, but the celebrants caught it and dragged it back to the center, where it at last fell still, its blood pouring into a pool of red foam around its throat. The crowd's keening noises and nervous laughter bloomed into a complex polyphony. The danger had brought the funeral to life. A goose was on a heated phone call. "What's the deal?" I asked Paul. "We need to bring a pig." "Where are we going to get a pig?" "A goose is finding one. It's rude to show up without a pig." The SUV was already full. There was me, Paul, a goose, the driver, and Atto, a 15-year-old boy catching a ride to the distant village. There was no room for a pig. A goose hung up the phone and announced, "Tomorrow my friend will bring the pig on his moped." Atto was texting furiously the whole ride, as you would expect from a teenager trapped in a car with adults. During the manene, the graves of his uncle and his great-grandfather would be opened. Both men had died before Atto was born, so he'd only ever met them as corpses. The village had no central square, but was a series of isolated hamlets. The majority of its people were rice farmers, including our hosts. They lived in 7 Tongkongnan, the sweeping Torajan homes on stilts, situated around a communal courtyard. Plump roosters crowed, skinny dogs chased the roosters, and laughing children chased the dogs. Women were beating the recently harvested rice with tall bamboo poles in a mesmerizing, repetitive motion. People trickled into the village to begin cleaning the 10 or so house graves that stood in a cluster. Heavy padlocks on the grave doors were a new development. It's not that the neighbors didn't trust one another, but a few years prior, a mummy had been stolen from the village and taken to Rontopau for sale to a collector. The villagers were tipped off as to who had taken it and went to Rontopau to steal it back. A group of men gathered to discuss the logistics of house grave ventilation. A villager named John Hans Tappi had been placed in one of the graves 2 years earlier. You could see his dark wood coffin propped up in the corner, through the open door. Tappi's son feared the air inside had been too wet, too humid. "I hope my father is still okay, still mummified, and has not gone rotten." This would be an important manene for John Hans Tappi. His son felt that when John died 2 years before, his family had not been able to do enough for him financially. They could not afford to sacrifice a buffalo in his honor, and the slight had haunted his son ever since. He believed that by not slaughtering the buffalo, my father was not carried to the second life. That would change this week. The buffalo was already selected and waiting in a nearby field. 2 house graves over, a woman pulled open the door and sprayed an industrial-sized can of lemon air freshener inside. Up the road, a family had slaughtered a pig and were awaiting the arrival of a Protestant priest to bless their new grave, which would hold 6 family members. They asked if we wanted to join them for dinner. Chunks of the pig's flesh were cubed and placed in bamboo tubes to be cooked over the fire. The pig had been butchered right next to the fire where it now roasted. Pools of pig blood stagnated as we ate, and several lazy flies buzzed around us. The severed hooves hung from a nearby bamboo scaffolding. A small dog dashed in and made off with a piece of the pig's offal, still dripping blood and fluid.
"Hey!"
the fire tender yelled after the beast, but left the dog alone to enjoy his prize. A woman offered me a bamboo leaf with a pile of warm pink rice on top. The bamboo tubes were pulled hot from the fire, the flesh still sizzling. Many of the pig chunks were pure fat. Halfway through the meal, I held up the bamboo leaf and looked closer at the crisp, fatty skin and saw the hair follicles still visible. "This is the flesh of a dead animal," I realized, and was, for the moment, repulsed. For as much time as I had spent facing human mortality, I didn't recognize a dead animal that didn't come wrapped in plastic and styrofoam. French anthropologist Noélie Veal wrote of the food system in France, though this could be said of almost any country in the West, slaughtering was required to be industrial, that is to say, large-scale and anonymous. It must be nonviolent, ideally painless, and it must be invisible, ideally non-existent. It must be as if it were not. It must be as if it were not. An old woman, so old her eyes had clouded over with cataracts, picked at a small pile of rice and gazed out over the valley. She didn't interact with anyone around her. Maybe she no longer could. A goose poked me with a pork-stained finger and whispered, "This grave will be hers." He was making fun of her, but also speaking a basic fact. This woman would soon go the way of her ancestors and would move into this new yellow house, the house without fire and smoke. Later that night, our pig arrived on the moped. It promptly took up residence under one of the houses and chomped away on food scraps, unaware that Paul and I had brought it here to meet its demise. When we did the math, I owed Paul $666 for the pig, the hotel, and Agus's service as a guide. My 2015 tax return had a write-off for a $666 sacrificial pig. That night, we slept in the belly of the Tongkongnan house. It seemed enormous from the outside, so we were surprised to climb up the wooden ladder and discover a single windowless room. Bedding was laid out on the floor, and we fell into a grateful sleep. It was only later in the night that we realized we were wrong about the lone room. Wooden latches in the wall opened into three other rooms. All night long, people quietly crawled in and out of the walls around us. The next morning began with the sound of a plaintive gong tolling along the village road. This announced the official start of the Manene. The first mummy I saw wore 80s-style aviator sunglasses with yellow-tinted frames. "Damn," I thought, "that guy looks like my middle school algebra teacher." One young man stood the mummy up as another sliced into its navy blazer with a pair of scissors, cutting all the way down to his pants, revealing the torso and legs. Given that this gentleman had been dead 8 years, he was remarkably well-preserved, with no obvious gashes or breaks in his flesh. Two coffins down, another fellow hadn't been so lucky. His body was now entirely shriveled, nothing left but thin strips of dried skin over bone, held together by gold-embroidered cloth. Wearing nothing but boxer shorts and the aviators, the mummy was placed on the ground, a pillow beneath his head. An 8-by-10-inch framed portrait photo, taken during his life, sat propped next to his body. Alive, he had looked far less like my math teacher than he did today, 8 years into mummification. A group of women fell to their knees beside the man and keened, wailing his name and stroking his cheeks. When their wails softened, the man's son moved in with a set of paintbrushes, the kind you buy at the local hardware store. The son began to clean the corpse, brushing his father's leathery skin with short, loving strokes. A cockroach scampered out from inside the boxer shorts. The son didn't seem to mind and carried on brushing. This was morning as I had never seen it before. 10 minutes earlier, a goose had received a call that there were mummies being unwrapped at a hard-to-reach grave by the river. We sped in that direction, running along a narrow dirt path through a rice field. The path ended in a ditch of brown water. With no ford or bridge, we groaned and plowed through the thick mud. I slid down an embankment on my butt. When we arrived at the site, almost 40 bodies had been removed from their house grave and lined up in rows on the ground. Some were wrapped in brightly colored cloths, some were in slender wooden coffins, and some were wrapped in cartoon quilts and blankets. We're talking Hello Kitty, SpongeBob SquarePants, and various Disney characters. The family moved from body to body, deciding whom to unwrap. Some were unknown. Nobody remembered exactly who they were. And some were top priority, a beloved husband or daughter whom they missed and couldn't wait to see again. A mother unwrapped her son, who had died when he was only 16. At first, all that could be seen was a crooked pair of feet. Hands emerged and seemed well enough preserved. Men on either side of the coffin pulled gently on the body, testing to see if they could lift it without the body crumbling. They managed to stand him vertical, and though his torso had been preserved, his face was skeletal, excepting his teeth and thick brown hair. His mother didn't seem to mind. She was ecstatic to see her child even for a moment, even in this state, and held his hand and touched his face. Nearby, a son brushed the skin of his father, whose face was stained pink from his batik wrapping. "He was a good man," he said. "He had 8 children, but he never beat us. I'm sad, but I'm happy because I can care for him as he did for me." The Tarajans talked directly to the corpses, narrating their next move. "Now I am removing you from the grave. I brought you cigarettes. I'm sorry I do not have more money. Your daughter and family have arrived from Makassar. Now I remove your coat." At the grave by the river, the leader of the family thanked us for coming and for bringing several boxes of cigarettes. He welcomed Paul to take pictures and me to ask questions. In return, he requested, "If you see any other outsiders to the village, do not tell them about this place. It is secret." I flashed back to the boorish German woman at the funeral, cigarette hanging from her mouth, iPad shoved in people's faces. I feared I had become that woman. Our desire to see something we had anticipated for months had driven us where we weren't wanted. We went back through the rice field, returning to the main road, to find that our host family had at last begun to remove and unwrap their dead. I recognized a man my age who worked as a graphic designer in Rontopau. He had arrived on his moped late the night before, climbing out of the wall as I slept. He pulled out a skeleton wrapped in gold fabric. "This is my brother. He died in a motorbike crash when he was 17. He pointed to the wrapped body next to him. "That is my grandfather." Down the hill from us, another family had laid out a picnic complete with a gingham blanket for their grandfather, who had died 7 years earlier. This was his second appearance at a Manene ceremony, and he was still in good shape, preservation-wise. His family brushed his face with a grass broom and flipped him over, peeling dried flesh from the back of his head. They stood him up for a family portrait, and the family gathered round, some stoic, some smiling. I was observing off to the side when a woman called me over to join the picture. I waved my hands as if to say, "Nope, terrible idea," but they insisted. Somewhere deep in Indonesia, there exists a picture of me with a Tarajan family and a freshly cleaned mummy. I had heard of mummification occurring in very dry or very cold climates, but the lush, humid air of Indonesia hardly fell into that category. So how did the dead of this village become mummies? The answer depended on who you asked. Some claimed they would only mummify the body in the old way, pouring oils into the person's mouth and throat and spreading special tea leaves and tree barks onto the skin. The tannins in the tea and bark bind with and shrink the proteins in the skin, making it stronger, stiffer, and more resistant to bacterial attack. The process is similar to how a taxidermist would preserve an animal hide, hence the word tanning in leather. The new trend in Turajan body mummification is none other than good old embalmer's formalin, a solution of formaldehyde, methyl alcohol, and water injected into the body. One woman I spoke to did not want her family members to receive the more invasive injections, but said in a conspiratorial tone, "I know other people are doing it." The villagers in this region of Turaja are amateur taxidermists of the human body. Given that the Turajans now use similar chemical formulas as North Americans to mummify their dead, I wondered why Westerners are so horrified at the practice. Perhaps it is not the extreme preservation that offends. Rather, it is that a Turajan body doesn't sequester itself in a sealed casket, walled in a cement fortress underneath the earth, but instead dares to hang around among the living. Which raises the question, why preserve the body so intensely if you're not planning to keep it around, America? Confronted with the idea of keeping Mom in the house for 7 years after her death, many Westerners picture the movie Psycho and its deranged hotel manager. The Turajan villagers preserve the corpses of their mothers. Norman Bates preserved the corpse of his mother. The villagers live with their bodies for many years. Norman lived with his mother's body for many years. The villagers have conversations with their bodies as if they are alive. Norman had conversations with his mother's body as if she were alive. But while these villagers spend an afternoon cleaning the graves, exuding a mundane normalcy, Norman Bates is the American Film Institute's second scariest movie villain of all time, coming in behind Hannibal Lecter and ahead of Darth Vader. He didn't win that sinister acclaim by murdering innocent hotel guests wearing his mother's clothing. He won it because Westerners feel there is something profoundly creepy about interacting with the dead over a long period of time. I've spoiled Psycho entirely. Apologies. Yesterday, I had met the son of John Hans Toppy. Today, I was going to meet John Hans himself. He was laid out, basking in the sun in plaid boxer shorts and a gold watch. His chest and abdominal cavity had been infused with formalin when he died, which explained why 2 years later his torso was flawlessly preserved, while his face had gone black and pockmarked, revealing bone below. When the family had to clean inside his boxers and brush around his mummified penis, they looked just as uncomfortable as you would expect. They made a self-deprecating joke and got the job done. Small children ran from mummy to mummy, inspecting and poking them before scampering away. One girl, about 5 years old, climbed up the side of a house grave to join me on the edge of a roof, above the bustle below. The two of us sat in silence, bound by a kinship of awkwardness, of preferring to watch from above. A goose spotted me up there and yelled, "Look! Makes me think about how I'm going to be like this. This is going to be me, eh?" Back at the house where we were staying, a 4-year-old boy watched us eat bowls of rice. He popped his head up from behind a railing and squealed with delight when I made faces back. His mother told him to leave us alone, so he found a paintbrush. He moved through the courtyard and squatted next to a dried bamboo leaf on the ground. He began to brush it, fully concentrated, hitting all the crevices. If the tradition of the Manene continues, chances are he will grow up to do that to a body, perhaps one of the people we met here in the village. The next morning, John Hanstapi had been redressed in new clothes, a button-up black jacket with gold buttons and navy slacks. He was making a move today to a new house grave down the road, light blue and topped with a white cross. The decoration on the grave was a cultural mix, traditional symbols of the buffalo, but also the Sacred Heart of the Virgin Mary, photos of Jesus praying, and a full rendering of the Last Supper. John Hahn's family propped him up and posed with him for one final picture in his new garb before placing him back in his coffin. They put his shiny black dress shoes next to his feet and pulled blankets over him, tucking him in. Closing the lid, they polished the sides and carried the coffin down the road on their shoulders, drumming and chanting as they went. That was the end of the excitement for John Hahn's, until 3 years later when he would emerge again. As I loaded the SUV, a goose remarked, "You know, there's a body in that house." He pointed to the Tarajan house next door to the one we had been sleeping in, all of 10 feet away. The family had been waiting to see how we'd react before telling us about a woman called Sanda, a 70-year-old who had died 2 weeks earlier. "Do you want to see her?" a goose asked. I gave a slow nod. Somehow, it made perfect sense that we had been snoozing corpse-adjacent our entire stay. "Hey, Paul," I whispered up the ladder up to our sleeping quarters. "I think you want to get down here." On a goose's instructions, we brought the remainder of our food to offer Sanda. She would know that we had brought it. We climbed into the back room, where Sanda lay on a dried bamboo mat. She was under a green plaid blanket, wearing an orange blouse and a pink scarf. Her purse was next to her, with food laid out. Her face was wrapped in cloths and had the rubbery texture I had seen so often in embalmed bodies. Sanda had been preserved with formalin, injected by a local specialist. The family couldn't do the injections themselves because the chemical formula was too spicy for their eyes. As successful rice farmers, Sanda's family did not have the time to tend to her body each day, as the old ways would require. Until she goes to her house grave, she will live with her family. They will bring her food, tea, and offerings. She visits them in their dreams. It had only been 2 weeks since she passed through the soft, porous border with death. After the odor had dispersed, her family planned to sleep in the same room with her. A goose, who, remember, slept with his dead grandfather for 7 years as a child, shrugged. "For us, we are used to it, this kind of thing. This life and death." Before arriving in Indonesia, I struggled to find descriptions of what rituals I would see in this area of Tanatoraja. Recent accounts, at least in English, are scarce. Googling the Manene directs you to Nene Leakes, the Real Housewife of Atlanta. Pictures are rare as well. The best images I could find appeared in the British tabloid The Daily Mail. I don't know where they got the pictures. They certainly didn't send a correspondent. The online comments section fascinated me. "Oh my God, whatever happened to RIP, said one commenter. "Seriously, this is so disrespectful," added another. And indeed, had the commenter disinterred Aunt Sally from the local cemetery in Minnesota and driven her corpse around a suburban neighborhood in a golf cart, yes, that would be disrespectful. The commenter hadn't grown up believing that familial relationships continue after the death of a body. For Tarajans, hauling someone out of their grave years after their death is not only respectful, the most respectful thing they can do, in fact, but it provides a meaningful way to stay connected to their dead. Being a mortician means everyone asks me questions about their mother's dead body. You have no idea how often I hear, "My mother died 11 years ago in upstate New York. She was embalmed and buried in the family plot. Could you describe what she'd look like now?" The answer depends on too many factors: the weather, the soil, the casket, the chemicals. I can never give a good answer. But as I watched the Tarajan families interact with their mummified mothers, I realized that they don't need to inquire with a mortician about the state of their mother's body. They know perfectly well what Mom is up to, even 11 years after her death. Seeing Mom again, even in this altered state, might be less frightening than the specters of the human imagination. Mexico, Michoacán. A skeleton, wearing a black bowler hat and smoking a cigar, swooped down Avenida Juarez, his long, bony arms waving madly. At 15 feet tall, he towered above the teeming crowds. Trailing behind him, men and women cavorted and danced, dressed as Calavera Katrina, the iconic dapper skeleton. A cloud of glitter shot out of a cannon as a phalanx of Aztec warriors twirled by on rollerblades. The crowd, tens of thousands strong, cheered and chanted. If you have seen the 2016 James Bond film Spectre, you will recognize this spectacle of flowers, skeletons, devils, and floats as Mexico City's annual Días de los Muertos, or Days of the Dead, parade. In the opening scene of the film, Bond glides through the melee in a skeleton mask and tux and slips into a hotel with a masked woman. Except, here's the trick. The Días de los Muertos parade did not inspire the James Bond film. The James Bond film inspired the parade. The Mexican government, afraid that people around the world would see the film and expect that the parade exists when it did not, recruited 1,200 volunteers and spent a year recreating the four-hour pageant. To some, the parade was a crass commercialization of the very private, family-centered festival that is Días de los Muertos, the 2 days at the beginning of November when the dead are said to return to indulge in the pleasures of the living. To others, it was Días de los Muertos' natural progression to a more secular, nationalistic holiday, boldly celebrating Mexico's history in front of a worldwide audience. When the parade was over, we trudged through the sparkle carnage left by the glitter cannons. My companion was Sarah Chavez, the director of my nonprofit, the Order of the Good Death. She pointed out the Días de los Muertos decorations that hung everywhere, in homes and businesses, calaveras and bright paper cutout skeletons. Oh, she had remembered something important. I forgot to tell you, they sell pan de muerto at the Starbucks by our hotel. Pan de muerto, or bread of the dead, is a roll baked with raised human bone formations and topped with sugar. The next day, we would be traveling west to Michoacán, a more rural area where families have long celebrated Días de los Muertos. But here, in Mexico City, there was a period in the early 20th century when Días de los Muertos fell out of popular favor. By the 1950s, Mexicans in urban areas viewed celebrating the Days of the Dead as outmoded folklore, practiced by people at the outskirts of civilized society. In an intriguing twist, one of the main motivators in changing that perception was the southward creep of Halloween from the United States. In the early 1970s, writers and intellectuals came to view Halloween as, in the words of journalist Maria Luisa Mendoza, a fiesta gringa, with witches on a broom and pointy hats, cats and pumpkins that are a pleasure to read about in detective books, but are absolutely unconnected to us. Mendoza wrote that her fellow Mexicans were ignoring the children who begged for pennies and cleaned car windshields just to survive, while in rich neighborhoods, our bourgeoisie mimic the Texans and allow their children to go into others' houses dressed ridiculously and ask for alms, which they will receive. During this time, as scholar Claudio Lomnitz wrote, the Days of the Dead became a generalized marker of national identity that stood opposite of the Americanized celebration of Halloween. Those who had once rejected the Días de los Muertos or who lived in areas where it had never been practiced at all, came to see the celebration as very Mexican. Not only did Días de los Muertos return to major cities, looking at you, James Bond parade, the festival also came to represent the struggles of many disenfranchised political groups. These groups adopted Días de los Muertos to mourn for those kept from the public eye, including sex workers, indigenous and gay rights groups, and Mexicans who had died trying to cross the border to the U.S. In the last 40 years, Días de los Muertos has come to represent popular culture, tourist culture, and protest culture throughout Mexico. And Mexico itself is viewed as a world leader in practicing engaged public grief. "I grew up with elders that were self-hating Mexicans," Sarah explained, as we sat in our hotel room in Michoacán the next day. "They were taught they had nothing to be proud of and everything to be ashamed of. They needed to assimilate. To be happy in America was to be as white as possible." Sarah's grandparents moved from Monterrey, Mexico, in the early 20th century, and settled in the East Los Angeles neighborhood known as Chavez Ravine. In 1950, the government sent letters to the 1,800 families of Chavez Ravine, mostly low-income Mexican-American farmers, informing them they would have to sell their homes to make way for public housing. The displaced families were promised new schools and playgrounds and housing priority when the developments were finished. Instead, after removing the families and destroying a community, the city of Los Angeles scrapped the public housing plan and partnered with a New York businessman to build Dodger Stadium. Supporters of the new stadium, including Ronald Reagan, called the critics baseball haters. Mexican Americans from Chavez Ravine were driven further east of Los Angeles by discriminatory housing practices. Sarah's parents came of age in this environment of displacement. They had Sarah when they were both 19. To this day, when my grandmother and aunts and uncles talk about Chavez Ravine, they are heartbroken. They miss it so, so much, Sarah said. When Sarah was born, she was not allowed to learn Spanish. She had lighter skin, which made her the favorite grandchild. Her Mexicanness was confined to the home. Growing up in Los Angeles, she bounced between a distant mother, her Hollywood costumer father, who to this day identifies not as Mexican but as American Indian, and her grandparents. Sarah grew comfortable being an American who happened to be Mexican, but felt little tangible connection to her family's culture. In 2013, after 10 years as a preschool and kindergarten teacher, Sarah fell in love with her partner Ruben, and the pair felt ready for a child of their own. She became pregnant. To Sarah, this child represented a chance to be a real family, my family, a chosen family, something no one could take away from me. This dream was not to be. Her son died when she was 6 months pregnant. The months that followed the death were a time of nobody and nothing. Sarah was estranged from her parents. She felt alone. There were days when she wanted to wander into the field of orange trees behind her house and disappear. Then there was the blame. Did I lift a heavy thing the wrong way? Did I eat the wrong thing? The archetypal woman is a bringer of life, Sarah said. But my body was a tomb. Sarah felt radioactive to all her friends and co-workers. She knew people wanted to live in a world where children are precious and invulnerable. I was asked by society to hide my grief, she said. They didn't want to confront such horrors. I was the face of those horrors. I was the boogeyman. Sarah scoured the internet for stories from other mothers who had suffered the death of a child. She found websites by well-meaning women, often with a very Christian overtone, e.g., "My angel has taken his place in the Lord's arms," and other stories that offered platitudes and euphemisms. To Sarah, these feel-good pick-me-ups were nothing but empty clichés. The accounts could not capture the wrenching agony and longing that she felt. Searching for comfort, she landed on the doorstep of her own heritage. "Sarah, you're Mexican. You come from arguably one of the most death-engaged cultures in the world," she thought. "How would your ancestors deal with this tragedy?" Mexican poet Octavio Paz famously said that while citizens of Western cities like New York, Paris, and London would burn their lips if they so much as uttered the word death, the Mexican, on the other hand, frequents it, mocks it, caresses it, sleeps with it, entertains it. It is one of his favorite playthings and his most enduring love. This is not to say Mexicans have never feared death. Their relationship with death was hard won. It emerged after centuries of brutality. Rather than becoming a proud and powerful empire, Claudio Lomnitz explained, Mexico was bullied, invaded, occupied, mutilated, and extorted by foreign powers and independent operators alike. In the 20th century, as the Western world reached its peak of repression and death denial, in Mexico, a gay familiarity with death became a cornerstone of national identity. For Sarah, coming to terms with her son's death wasn't an attempt to erase her fear of mortality. She knew such a task was impossible. She just wanted to engage with death, to be allowed to speak its name. As Paz said, frequent it, mock it, caress it. Many children and grandchildren of immigrants have, like Sarah, found themselves severed from their family's cultural rituals. The funeral system in the United States is notorious for passing laws and regulations interfering with diverse death practices and enforcing assimilation toward Americanized norms. In a particularly heartbreaking example, many Muslims would like to be able to open funeral homes in the U.S. and serve their communities as licensed funeral directors. Islamic custom is to wash and purify the body immediately after death, before burying it as quickly as possible, ideally before nightfall. The Muslim community rejects embalming, recoiling at the idea of cutting into the body and injecting it with chemicals and preservatives. Yet many states have draconian regulations requiring funeral homes to offer embalming and all funeral directors to be trained as embalmers, despite the fact that the embalming process itself is never required. Muslim funeral directors must compromise their beliefs if they want a chance to help their community in death. Sarah's first and most lasting gateway into Mexican culture was the work of the painter Frida Kahlo, Mexico's Heroína del Dolor, the heroine of pain. In her 1932 self-portrait on the borderline between Mexico and the United States, a defiant Frida straddles an imaginary boundary between Mexico and Detroit, where she was living at the time with her husband, the muralist Diego Rivera. The Mexican side is strewn with skulls, ruins, plants, and flowers with thick roots burrowed deep into the soil. The Detroit side contains factories, skyscrapers, and plumes of smoke, an industrial city that hides the natural cycle of life and death. While living in Detroit, Kahlo became pregnant. She wrote of the pregnancy to her former physician, Leo Eloesser, her devoted correspondent from 1932 to 1951. She worried that pregnancy was too dangerous, that her body had been damaged by the famous streetcar accident that shattered part of her pelvis and punctured her uterus. Kahlo reported that her doctor in Detroit gave me quinine and very strong castor oil for purge. When the chemicals failed to end the pregnancy, her doctor declined to perform a surgical abortion, and Kahlo faced the prospect of carrying the risky pregnancy to term. She begged Eloesser to write her doctor in Detroit. Since performing an abortion is against the law, maybe he is scared or something. And later it would be impossible to undergo such an operation. We don't know how Eloesser responded to Kahlo's request, but 2 months later, she suffered a violent miscarriage. In a painting she created after her experience, Henry Ford Hospital, La Cama Volando, Frida lies naked on a hospital bed, the sheets soaked with blood. Objects float in the space around her, attached to her stomach by umbilical cords made of red ribbon. A male fetus, her son, medical objects, and symbols like a snail and an orchid.